Chapter 2, Concerning the Being and Perfections of God. Though the evidence of the existence of God be as clear and certain as that of our own, or of anything else whatsoever, and it is one of the first dictates of reason when offered to consideration and attended to, and has, by general consent, been acknowledged by mankind in all ages as most demonstrable and certain, yet it is most probable that even the knowledge and general acknowledgement of this truth depends greatly, if not completely, upon divine revelation. Mankind are so alienated from the life of God through the ignorance that is in them because of the blindness of their hearts, and so disposed by their depravity and wickedness to sink down into brutish ignorance and stupidity with regard to everything invisible, that if they were not first told that there is a God, they would most probably grow up without believing or even thinking of this truth. The general acknowledgement of the being of God is no evidence that it does not originate from divine revelation, for there are many things generally believed and practiced in the heathen world, in their religions, which evidently depend upon tradition, and though in many respects corrupted, had their original in divine revelation, handed down from Noah and his sons, or taken from the Jews, and the revelation given to them. But one instance shall be mentioned, and that is to say, the practice of sacrificing beasts or some animals to appease the gods, or ingratiating themselves with them, which has so generally obtained in the heathen world, and which most certainly never would have been thought of by men had not God first instituted it by revelation, and from that it was handed down, and the practice kept up among all nations, even long after they had lost or corrupted the original intent and design of such sacrifices. And so the belief of the being of a God may derive from the same origin, and be handed down from generation to generation the same way. The following facts seem to favor this supposition, if they do not clearly prove it. Number one, the absurd and ridiculous notions respecting God, or a plurality of gods, which have generally taken place in the heathen world. Well, such as the following. That is to say, there are many gods, both male and female, that they are embodied like men and women, and have carnal affections, lusts, commit adulteries and rapes, etc., have cruel hatred and contentions with one another, are taking advantage of each other by deceit and cunning like the Greek gods, or by power to accomplish their own selfish, unreasonable inclinations and designs, etc., etc. All this can be well accounted for on supposition that their belief of the being of God depends chiefly upon tradition, and for this truth, being thus handed down by tradition, would naturally and easily be corrupted and blended with endless absurd notions, according to the foolish and wicked humors and inclinations of mankind, which has been the case of all religious truths among the heathen, which originated from revelation. But if we suppose all nations ill the heathen world, believe the existence of God by reasoning themselves into it, and attending to the clear and abundant evidence there is of this, well, how can it be accounted for that they should make no use of their reason in forming their notions of deity and determining what kind of a being a god must be? But, contrary to all the dictates of reason and the clearest evidence, embrace the greatest absurdities? If their belief in the first instance be founded on the dictates of reason and evidence, why is reason completely laid aside in the latter? And as soon as they have reasoned themselves into the being of a god, make no further use of their reason, but most unreasonably believe that there are many gods and embrace the greatest absurdities respecting deity. Well, number two, those people and nations who are most out of the reach of the instruction and influence of divine revelation and of the traditions which originated from it have the most faint belief and make the least acknowledgement of the being of a god. And historians and travelers tell us that there are people, even entire nations, among whom there is not any acknowledgement of any kind of god, or the least appearance of the belief of any. Well, these are nations which, by their situation and circumstances, are most out of the way of receiving any advantage by revelation, and by being long unconnected, and without any intercourse, that's discussion, with other nations, have by degrees lost all tradition relating to everything invisible. And this seems to be a proof that if mankind were without all the light and advantages of a revelation and traditions which originate from it, well, they would not pay any regard to an invisible supreme being, or entertain any belief or notion of such a being, but would, in every sense, quote, live without God in the world, close quote. And, by the way, this may serve to show what need mankind stand in of a divine revelation, and that all religious light and knowledge originates completely from this source. Number three, there have been instances of persons who have been deaf from their birth and consequently dumb. And after they have arrived to adult or middle age, have been able to hear and speak. And though before this they attended public worship with others and appeared very devout and often made those signs which those with whom they conversed in this way thought were expressions of their belief of the being of God and of their piety. Yet, when they came to hear and speak, they declared that they never had a thought that there was a God until they could hear and were by that means informed. And there never has been an instance known of any such persons declaring that he had any belief or thought in the existence of a God before he could hear and speak. Are not these facts an evidence that though the being of God is so clearly manifested in the works of creation and providence, yet mankind, in their present, fallen, corrupt state, would not discern and acknowledge this truth had it not been otherwise revealed? And since the nature of all sin, so far as it has dominion in the human heart, that is real atheism and a denial of the God who is above. And therefore, the fool, the wicked man, always says in his heart, quote, there is no God, close quote. And the tendency of it is to darken and stupefy the mind. Or rather, it is itself blindness and stupidity with regard to the being of God and everything invisible, and naturally shuts all these things out of the mind. It can be easily accounted for that without a revelation, the reason of man, who is totally corrupt and sinful, will never suggest to him the being of a God, however evident and demonstrable this is to reason when once suggested and revealed, and men can be excited and persuaded to attend to the evidence. and exercise their reason on the subject. But we will now take a short and summary view of the evidence there is of this great and fundamental truth of all morality and religion, and mention some of the arguments which offer themselves to our reason when we attend to the subject. And these are not long and intricate, but when the truth is once suggested to us, it becomes an object of intuition, in a sense, so that though there be reasoning in the case, it is so short and easy that it strikes the mind all at once, and it is hardly conscious of any reasoning upon it, and of the medium by which the evidence comes to the mind. And hence it is probable that some have thought, doubtless without any good reason for it, that the existence of God is what they call an innate idea, which is essential to the mind of man and impressed on it, independent of all reasoning on the subject. Roman numeral number 1. It is certain there is a God from our own existence and the things we behold around us. And there must be some cause of the existence of these things. They could not cause their own existence or make themselves, because this is a contradiction. There must therefore be some invisible cause which existed before them and was able to give them existence and to uphold them when they were made. This is the first cause, maker and preserver of all things. This first cause is God Himself. It is natural for the inquisitive mind, when it is necessarily led thus far, to inquire how God came to exist, or what is the cause of His existence. If He be the first cause, He must be the cause of His own existence, which implies a contradiction, or He must exist without any cause and without beginning, which is perfectly inconceivable. And we may as well suppose the world exists without a cause too, and go no farther back for a cause, and then we find no evidence of the existence of God. Well, here's the answer to this point of view, or this query. Answer. The first cause of all things we behold must certainly exist without beginning, and so without any cause that is antecedent to His existence, or that is, without Himself. Yet there may be a reason or cause of His existence within Himself. In other words, the necessity of His existence, so that He exists necessarily, there being no other possible way or supposition, or it being infinitely impossible it should be otherwise. Universal non-existence being the greatest contradiction in nature. If it should be said that this runs all into darkness, for we can no more conceive of God's existing necessarily and without beginning to exist than we can of the world's existing without a cause, and therefore gives no relief to the mind. An easy, and it is hoped, a satisfactory answer is at hand. It is plain contradiction to say that the world and all things in it exist without a cause, or a reason why they exist, rather than not. But necessary existence and existence without beginning implies no contradiction or impossibility. No, it is granted that each of them is to us incomprehensible. But this is so far from being any argument against the truth and the reality of them, that it is rather an evidence in favor of them. For if there is a God, if there be a God, he must be incomprehensible, as he is an infinite being, and exists in a manner infinitely above us. Therefore, must be infinitely above and beyond the comprehension of finite minds. The potter and the clay analogy or illustration is a good way to describe that. It is very unreasonable to object that against the being of a God, which certainly must be true if God exists. Roman numeral number 2. The being of God is evident from the manner of our own existence and of all things that are visible, that we can see with our eyes. In other words, the design, contrivance, and wisdom that appear in them. It would fill volumes fully to illustrate this argument from the works of creation and providence, as this design and wisdom appear in them all. And the more particularly they are considered, that means thought upon, for those who don't understand what considered is, the more clear the wisdom appears and shines. Volumes have been written on the subject, and many more might be written, and yet the subject not be exhausted. But it is not consistent with the design of this work to enter particularly into this subject. Everyone must have observed so much of this as to see the propriety and force of this argument at first view, unless he be very criminally inattentive. The innumerable creatures and things which come under our observation appear to be contrived and formed to answer some end, and the numerous ranks of different animals are all furnished with provision for their own support and defense, and have members and organs suited to their situation, and to obtain, receive, and use what is necessary for the support of their lives, etc. If we attend only to our own bodies, we shall find them so admirably contrived and so curiously formed. And though of so many parts, each one is suited to the rest, and all so contrived as to form one harmonious system of animal life, without any defect or anything superfluous. It is possible, if we make any proper use of our reason, that we should find ourselves inhabiting such bodies without discerning the contrivance and wisdom of our making, and seeing and acknowledging the hand and skill of the wise author, author with a capital A, of this frame, so curious in all its parts and movements. As well may we behold a most beautiful, well-contrived palace, furnished with everything convenient and comfortable to dwell in, having nothing useless, nothing lacking, and not have one thought of a wise, skillful architect who contrived and built it, or imagined this building might exist without the exertion of any design or wisdom, and have no author and maker. Well, surely we cannot survey ourselves and the world in which we live and see the design and contrivance apparently running through the whole and not be convinced that there must be a wise contriver and author who has made them. Not to think of and acknowledge this, is to be more like the beasts than rational creatures. The language of the psalmist is most rational and natural when contemplating the works of creation and providence. Quote, O Lord, how manifold are thy works! In wisdom hast thou made them all. Close quote. Roman numeral number 3. The being of God is made evident by the Holy Scriptures, not merely by being there abundantly asserted, but by the existence of such a book as the Bible. It is as much impossible there should be such a book were there no God, as that there should be a world as we see without an invisible cause. For it is as much beyond the power and skill of a man, or any number of men, to form such a book as it is to make the world. It is impossible that such a number of men, who lived in ages at such a distance from each other, should write so much and not contradict themselves, nor each other, but agree and harmonize in everything. Were there no invisible, unerring, omniscient being to direct and guide them? As impossible as it was that every stone and piece of timber in Solomon's temple should come together and be exactly fitted to its place so as to make one complete, harmonious building without any design or contrivance, but by mere accident or chance. The character of God there is given far above and beside the thought of man, and could no more be drawn by man, were there no such God, than the world can be made by him, that is, by man. And the law of God there given, and at last summed up and comprehended, in one sentence, quote, Thou shalt love the Lord with all thy heart, and thy neighbor as thyself, close quote, could no more be thought of and contrived by man than the heavens and the earth could be planned and produced by him. The series of miracles wrought by those who said there was a God, and that Jehovah was the only true God, that he spake to them, and they did these wonders in his name and by his power, are a standing proof of the existence of God. But above all, the predictions contained in the Bible, with their exact and certain accomplishment, is a striking proof and demonstration of the existence of an omniscient, omnipotent being. For it is as much beyond the art and power of men to foretell so many thousand events, so precisely answering the prediction, as it is for him to make the sun, the moon, or the stars. All these have been urged as proofs of the divinity of the Scriptures, and they are equal proofs of the being of God. And therefore, though invisible things of God are clearly seen in the works of creation and providence, even his eternal power and Godhead, so that all the nations who have not the Bible are left without excuse, which if they do not believe in, love, and worship the true God. Yet, they who enjoy this book have more clear evidence of the being of God, as well as unspeakably greater advantages to know his true character, and consequently are far more inexcusable than the heathen if they do not believe. Upon the evidence of the existence of God, two things may be observed. Number one, though this be as evident a truth as any whatsoever, and men may have a full rational conviction of it, while their hearts are opposite to it, and receive no impressions answerable to this truth, and the whole system of their affections and exercises of heart are just as if this were not true, or directly contrary to it, yet do really say in their hearts, there is no God. Therefore we find this asserted in the Scriptures, quote, "The fool," that is the wicked man whose heart is completely corrupted, as it is there explained, "the fool says in his heart, there is no God," close quote. And hence it is that this conviction and profession that there is a God in multitudes of instances has little or no effect on the heart and practice. But while they profess to know there is a God in their hearts and in their works, they deny him. And in this case, the heart governs the man and forms his true moral character, and not his speculative conviction and judgment, which is so weak and ineffectual that it flies or vanishes into nothing before the strong, fixed propensities of the ungodly heart, as a bubble is blown away by the strong blast of a furious wind. Number two, where the heart is upright and honest, and men have a proper taste and relish for moral truth, the evidence of the being of God is discerned in a true light. The being and true character of God appear to be a pleasing reality. They have a genuine and powerful impression on the heart, and its leading affections and exercises are answerable to the truth. And therefore, the Scriptures represent such only as knowing God and believing in him. And others are spoken of as not knowing God, and saying in their hearts there is no God, and in their works denying him. The latter are in darkness, and walk in darkness, which blinds their eyes. The God of this world has blinded their minds, so that they believe not. And the light of the glorious gospel of Christ, who is the image of God, does not shine unto them. But the light shines into the hearts of the former, and gives them the light of the knowledge of the glory of God in the face of Jesus Christ. For where the being of God is truly discerned, his whole revealed character or his glory is in some good measure seen. And they who have not discerning and relish of this glory, which is true of all wicked men, they have not that belief of the being of God, which good men do have, as their faith consists in mere speculation, which is not the true light. And this is so plain that even the heathen have said, quote, "The mind destitute of virtue cannot see the beauty of truth," close quote. Okay, this leads us to consider the character and perfections of God, or what God is. And this is the most important subject in the whole compass of divinity, as right conceptions of God lay the best and only foundation for religious knowledge and right sentiments in general. And it is no doubt true that all who agree in their sentiments respecting the divine character will also agree in the same system of religious truth. And the origin of the difference and opposition of opinion that have taken place among professing Christians, respecting the doctrines of Christianity, is their different and opposite notions of the character and perfections of God. Therefore, the true knowledge of God is often mentioned in Scripture as the sum of all knowledge and comprehending all religious knowledge. This affords a good reason for our attending to this awful subject with great care and caution, with solemnity of mind, reverence, and devotion, searching the Holy Scriptures, and praying that we may be saved from wrong and dishonorable conceptions of the being of God, and rather obtain the true knowledge of Him. What are called the natural perfections of God, as distinguished from His moral perfections, are first to be considered. There is a general agreement respecting these among those who enjoy divine revelation, as men are not so prone to prejudice and error on this head as they are concerning the other. It will therefore be needless to enlarge here. We are warranted by the Scriptures, and it appears reasonable to exclude everything that implies any imperfection when we consider what God is, and ascribe to Him nothing that is not absolutely perfect in the highest degree. Therefore, we must conceive God to be a pure spirit, which the Scriptures assert. John chapter 4, verses 20 through 24 declares that. And hence are we certain that nothing corporeal, or that has any shape, figure, or limits, is to be ascribed to Him. Hence it is unreasonable and very dishonorable to God to attempt to make any image or likeness of Him by anything that has figure or shape, or to form or entertain any such notion or vision in our minds. Moses gave a particular caution on this head to the people of Israel. Quote, "The Lord spake unto you out of the midst of the fire. Ye heard the voice of the words, but saw no similitude. Only ye heard a voice. Take ye therefore good heed unto yourselves, lest ye corrupt yourselves, and make you a graven image, the similitude of any figure. For ye saw no manner of similitude on the day that the Lord spake unto you in Horeb, out of the midst of the fire." Close quote. And this is expressly prohibited in the second commandment. Quote, "Thou shalt not make unto thee any graven image, or any likeness of anything that is in heaven above, or that is in the earth beneath, or that is in the water under the earth." Close quote. Therefore, when God is spoken of in the Scriptures as if He had bodily parts and members, hands, eyes, ears, mouth, etc., these expressions are to be taken in a figurative sense and mean no more than that God does see and hear, etc., which we perform by those members and organs, and not that he has eyes of flesh or sees as a man does. Such language being used as better suited to convey knowledge to our minds in conformity to man's manner and way of speaking and conceiving or understanding, conceiving in your mind, thinking, you know, like visual people. You got hands-on people and you've got visual people. Okay, this is what Hopkins is saying. In the scriptures, God is represented as an infinite being that he is in every respect without limits or boundaries. His existence is infinite, or in him is an infinite degree of existence, so that all created existence is nothing when compared with him. And indeed, is comprehended in him, and is really no addition to existence, it being only an emanation from him, the fountain and sum of all existence. And all his attributes and perfections are infinite, according to the scriptures. Quote, his understanding is infinite, close quote. And consequently, everything that can be attributed to him. And reason teaches that God must be infinite. He who exists without any cause, that is, without himself, or who exists of and from himself, from the necessity of his own nature, or, in other words, exists necessarily, must be infinite, or cannot have any boundaries or limitations in any respect, and that for these two plain reasons. Number one, he can be limited or bounded by no thing, because there is nothing to limit him, no possible cause or reason of any kind of limitation, and therefore there can be none. Number two, necessary existence must be infinite, for as there can be nothing to bound this necessity, it must take place with respect to every possible degree of existence, and is as much a reason of infinite existence as of any existence at all. If any existence be necessary, infinite existence is necessary, so that it is a plain contradiction to suppose that God exists of himself or necessarily and yet has but a limited degree of existence or is not infinite. And hence it appears that God exists without beginning or end, or is eternal as he is represented in the scriptures. For he has no limits, but is infinite, can have neither beginning or end, or must be infinite in duration. And necessary existence must be eternal, because this same necessity cannot be limited as to time or duration, but is rather always the same. It is a contradiction to say that self-existence, or which is the same necessary existence, does not exist or can cease to exist. And for the same reason, God is unchangeable in every respect, which the Holy Scriptures abundantly assert. He who exists necessarily and is infinite must exist unchangeably in the most perfect manner and degree change, or alteration in any respect necessarily supposes limitation and imperfection. And as God is eternal and immutable, he must be without any succession. For this supposes change and an advance in years and increase of duration. God does not grow older, and there is nothing first or last, no beginning or end, past or to come, with respect to him. He has no change or succession of ideas, but rather he inhabits or possesses eternity without the least variation or shadow of turning. God is perfect and infinite in understanding and knowledge. He is omnipresent, which is necessarily implied in his infinite, unlimited existence. God is almighty. He can do what he pleases, and nothing is impossible with him. And he must be absolutely and infinitely independent and all-sufficient. Look, brothers and sisters, all of this is asserted in the scriptures, and it is easy to see that they are essential to the character of God, who made and governs in the present, governs the world, and is to be trusted in all or every case, and he is to be worshipped. God is invisible. Invisibility is ascribed to him in the scriptures as essential and peculiar to him. And the meaning is not merely that he is invisible, as all pure spirits are, not to be seen by our bodily eyes, but he is not to be seen by any created mind, by direct, immediate intuition, nor can he be ever seen thus to all eternity, but only as he reveals and manifests himself, etc., by his works or some other medium or exhibition. And this seems to be asserted in the following words, quote, "No man has seen God at any time. The only begotten Son, which is in the bosom of the Father, he hath declared him," close quote. It is to be observed that the word man is not in the original, but it is none or no one has seen God. No one has seen him. And the assertion may be considered as extending to angels as well as men. And the Apostle Paul says himself, "No man has seen nor can see God." God is incomprehensible by all finite minds. This is as evident and certain as it is that what is finite cannot reach unto and comprehend infinity. But a little portion can be known of God compared with the whole of his existence. And none among men or angels can by searching find out God to perfection, though under the best possible advantages and possessed of the greatest abilities to search, and though they exert all their powers and strength to the utmost, and wisely improve every advantage to get knowledge without intermission and without end. Though they should make the swiftest progress imaginable in the knowledge of God, they would still fall infinitely short of fully comprehending all that is in God, or even any one thing. For however great and extensive this knowledge may be in itself considered, yet it is but finite, and therefore is infinitely less than the perfect, adequate knowledge of an infinite being. Creatures may have the true knowledge of God. They may know something of Him, and what they know may be agreeable to the truth. But this is infinitely short of comprehending His being, or any of His attributes and perfections. This plain truth may well be improved to teach us modesty in our inquiries about God, and also show us the arrogancy and folly of those who refuse to believe anything respecting the existence, character, or works of God, which cannot be comprehended. And such, while they are valuing themselves for their own reasoning abilities, are acting a most unreasonable part. How unreasonable are they who doubt of the being or any of the perfections of God, only because they cannot fully understand and comprehend how they can be? For if there be a God clothed with infinite perfection, He must be incomprehensible. They who will not believe in a God whose being and manner of existence are beyond their comprehension must certainly have no true God, for what they reject is essential to the true God. And were there nothing incomprehensible, it is certain there could be no God. The moral perfections of God are next to be considered, or what the scriptures say of His moral character. As this is of the greatest importance to be known, we may be sure it is very clearly discovered and precisely stated in divine revelation, whatever mistakes men may make about it, and however they may differ in their sentiments concerning those divine attributes. We have therefore the greatest reason and encouragement to search the scriptures with attention and care, and upright and honest hearts, that we may find the knowledge of God in this part of His character. The following general observations may be made concerning the moral perfections of God before they are considered more particularly. Number one. The infinite excellence, beauty, and glory of God consist wholly in His moral perfections and character. Infinite greatness, understanding, and power, without any rectitude, wisdom, and goodness of heart, if this were possible, would not be desirable and amiable, but worse than nothing and infinitely dreadful. Therefore, they who do not understand the true moral character of God and discern the excellence and glory of it, they have not the knowledge of God. His real amiableness and glory are hidden from them. And this being true of all whose moral character is completely evil, and who have hearts altogether opposed to the moral perfections of God. They are represented in the scriptures as not knowing God. Quote, "He that saith, I know him, and keepeth not his commandments, is a liar, and the truth is not in him." Close quote. Here's another quote. "He that loveth not, knoweth not God, for God is love." Close quote. Number two, the moral character and perfection of God consists in His holiness. Holiness comprehends all that belongs to his moral character and does not consist in any particular attribute distinct from any other moral perfection. The holiness of God is his goodness, wisdom, justice, truth, and faithfulness, etc. It consists in these and cannot be distinguished from them. Therefore, they who have considered holiness as a distinct attribute of God and have attempted to describe it as being distinguished from goodness, wisdom, etc., do not appear to have any distinct, clear ideas, and are able to give any satisfactory or intelligible definition of it. It does not appear that the scriptures warrant any such distinction. But there, the holiness of God means the goodness of his moral character in general. And we find that when it is applied to men, it denotes a virtuous moral character and conduct, and comprehends everything morally good, even every branch of moral excellence. And should anyone attempt to define the holiness of a man as distinct from goodness, his love to God and his neighbor, his humility, righteousness, and temperance, he not only would have no scriptural warrant to say it, but he must run himself into the darkness and be altogether unintelligible to himself and to others. Number 3, the whole of true holiness, or the moral excellence and perfection of God, is comprehended in love, or goodness, by whatever names it may be called. Where there is no love or goodness of heart, there is nothing morally good. And where this love or goodness is, there is every moral virtue and excellence as necessarily involved and implied in it. Therefore, infinite goodness is infinite moral perfection and forms an absolutely perfect and infinitely excellent moral character. By this, love and goodness is meant as good will, with every affection necessarily implied in it. That universal benevolence which consists in a disposition to seek and promote the greatest possible general good and happiness, and all those affections and exercises, and that conduct in which this is expressed and acted out. What absolutely perfect and infinite benevolence and goodness implies, and contains in the nature of it, and that nothing can be added to it to form an infinitely excellent moral character, will be more particularly considered and evidenced hereafter. But it is proper first to consider what evidence we have from the scriptures that the divine moral character, or the holiness of God, consists wholly, that's wholly, which means completely, in this. Number one, the holy law of God, which is not only the standard of holiness or of moral excellence and perfection in the creature, but an expression of transcript of divine holiness, requires nothing but love or goodness, so that he who loveth, as the law of God requires, is perfectly conformed to the law, which is the same with being perfectly holy. And this perfect conformity or likeness to God in his moral character, or holiness in the creature is the moral image of God. Therefore, God says to men, quote, "Be ye holy, for I am holy," close quote. The Lord Jesus Christ has taught us that the holy law of God requires nothing but love in the following remarkable words, quote, "Thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart and with all thy soul and with all thy mind. This is the first and great commandment, and the second is like unto it. Thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. On these two commandments hang all the law and the prophets," close quote. And agreeable to this, the Apostle Paul says, quote, "Love is the fulfilling of the law," close quote. Nothing can be more expressly asserted than this. I mean, that is to say, that love, exercised to a proper degree, and expressed and acted out in all proper ways, forms a perfect moral character, and therefore that the divine moral character consists wholly or completely in this. Number two, the Apostle John says repeatedly that God is love, and he that dwelleth in love dwelleth in God, and God in him. Here all the moral perfections of God are comprehended in love, and by this the whole of his moral character is expressed. If we know what love is, we know what God is, for God is love. And if we dwell in love, we are conformed to God, and he dwelleth in us. His moral image is formed in us by love. Number three, when Moses besought God to show him his glory, well, in answer to this petition, God said, quote, "I will make all my goodness pass before thee," close quote. And when he granted this petition, it is said, quote, "The Lord descended in the cloud and stood with him there and proclaimed the name of the Lord. And the Lord passed by before him and proclaimed, the Lord God, merciful and gracious, long-suffering and abundant in goodness and truth." Close quote. The glory of God consists in his moral perfection and character. But when he proposes to show this, his glory to Moses, he mentions his goodness and nothing else. Quote, "I will make all my goodness to pass before thee," close quote. And again, that's to say, I have no glory to show but my goodness. This is the whole of my moral beauty and excellence. And when it is said, quote, "He proclaimed the name of the Lord," close quote, it means that he proclaimed his character and declared that in which his moral and his moral perfection and glory did consist. And here is nothing but goodness or love mentioned. Love in the highest, most resplendent and glorious exercises and manifestations of it in the pardon and salvation of sinners. Truth is indeed mentioned here, but not as anything distinct from goodness or benevolence, but as that which is necessarily included in it. But this leads to a more particular consideration of the moral perfections of God, which are included in love or goodness. Number one, infinite wisdom is a moral perfection of God. Wisdom consists in discerning and proposing the highest and best end, and fixing on and pursuing the most proper and best way and means in order to accomplish it. Infinite wisdom does this with infinite ease and without any possibility of the least error and mistake. And it is certain that this wisdom is a moral excellence and belongs to the heart, and therefore does not consist in mere speculation or that knowledge or understanding which may be without any rectitude or goodness of disposition or heart. Satan, who has no moral goodness, has no wisdom. He does not discern and propose any good end, but rather the contrary, and is also devising and pursuing methods to accomplish his evil designs. And therefore, however clear and right his speculations may be in some instances, and though he may be very subtle and cunning, he has no wisdom and no true discerning in things of a moral nature. But all his proposals, designs, and pursuits are directly the reverse or opposite of wisdom. They are consummate folly and madness. Therefore, the scriptures speak of wisdom as a moral excellence, yea, as including all moral rectitude, and perfectly opposed to all folly or moral evil. And a wise and understanding heart in the scriptures means a moral excellence depending on the disposition of the heart and not consisting in any knowledge and speculations which are consistent with a corrupt and evil heart. Of this, every one who has attended to the Bible must be sensible, and it is therefore needless to produce passages here to prove it. This true wisdom is called light in the scriptures, in which sense God is said to be light and to dwell in light. Quote, God is light, and in him is no darkness at all. Close quote. Wisdom and goodness or benevolence are not to be considered as distinct, and the former as independent of the latter. Where there is no benevolence, there is no wisdom. For where benevolence or goodness is not, there is no good end proposed and pursued or discerned. It is benevolence alone that seeks the highest general good and proposes and pursues the best end. And where this is not, the true good is not discerned, and therefore the best end is not proposed, sought, or perceived. And this, therefore, gives or contains all the light and discerning there is in true wisdom. If we have a just idea of benevolence or goodness of heart, and know what that is, well, we have an idea of true wisdom, the latter being necessarily included in the former. And this will be evident to everyone who considers and understands what benevolence is, and what is true wisdom, so that no farther proof of this point will be needed. This is agreeable to what is said in the scriptures of benevolence and wisdom. There, love or benevolence is represented as being or containing all that light and knowledge which is in true wisdom, and that where this love is not, there is not any degree of this light and discerning. Quote, everyone that loveth knoweth God. He that loveth not knoweth not God. He that saith he is in the light and hates his brother is in darkness even until now. He that loves his brother abides in the light. But he that hates his brother is in darkness and walks in darkness. Close quote. And here, love is said to be, or imply, all that light and discerning which is of a moral nature, in which true wisdom consists. And therefore, love is wisdom. Love is true light and discerning. And this is true wisdom. Love is the true knowledge of God, or implies it, and is essential to it. And in the knowledge of God, true wisdom consists. Quote, if thou incline thine ear unto wisdom, and apply thine heart to understanding, thou shalt then understand the fear of the Lord, and find the knowledge of God. For the Lord giveth wisdom. Close quote. Moreover, the scriptures teach us that wisdom, considered as proposing and pursuing a good end by the best means, consists in love. And there it is said, quote, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge. But fools despise wisdom and instruction. Close quote. And unto man he said, quote, the fear of the Lord, that is wisdom. And to depart from evil is understanding. Close quote. By the fear of the Lord is evidently meant true piety or obedience to God in keeping his commandments, which consists completely in love. Love to God and our neighbor. And this, it is said, is true wisdom and is the beginning of wisdom. There is no wisdom where there is no love to God. And wisdom begins in this. And this is wisdom itself. Therefore, according to the scriptures, love is wisdom and understanding. Agreeable to this, all true virtue and moral rectitude, which consists in love, is called wisdom in the Proverbs of Solomon and throughout the Bible. And the contrary is called folly. And the former is called understanding and knowledge. The latter, darkness and ignorance. And hence it appears, not only that wisdom is moral rectitude and excellence and a moral perfection of God, but also that it is nothing more than benevolence or goodness and is included in it. So that when it is said God is love, his wisdom is asserted, as well as his goodness, because love or goodness is wisdom itself. Number two, justice or righteousness belongs to the moral character of God. And this denotes, in general, the perfect and infinite rectitude of his will, in opposition to all injustice or unrighteousness. The scriptures constantly ascribe this to God as essential to the perfection and glory of his character, as everyone must be sensible who is acquainted with the Bible. Quote, he is the rock, his work is perfect, for all his ways are judgment. A God of truth and without iniquity, just and right is he. Close quote. Here's another quote. The Lord is righteous in all his ways. Close quote. Righteousness often has a very extensive meaning in the scriptures and seems frequently to be used to express the whole of the moral character and glory of God, or his moral rectitude in general, as it is also often used to express the moral character of a man who is conformed to God or true holiness. Quote, put on the new man, which, after God, is created in righteousness and true holiness. Close quote. Here, righteousness and true holiness seem to mean the same thing, and the latter, true holiness, is put as exegetical of the former, because righteousness expresses the whole of moral rectitude, both in God and the creature. Quote, blessed are they who hunger and thirst after righteousness. Close quote. That is, true holiness. But the instances of righteousness being used in the scriptures in this extensive sense, as including all moral goodness, are too many to be particularly mentioned here. Everyone who has read the Bible knows that the words just and righteous are commonly used to denote that moral character, rectitude, and holiness by which good or holy men are distinguished from the rest. To be righteous is to be right according to the rule, the holy law of God, the standard of all moral rectitude, and therefore must include universal holiness. But righteousness and justice are sometimes used in the scriptures in a more limited sense, both when applied to God and to men. And to be just or righteous is to be disposed to do no wrong to anyone, and actually to do no wrong, but to give to everyone and everything to which he has a right and may justly claim as his due, and is therefore opposed to doing wrong or injuring any being by withholding or taking from him that to which he has a right, which is called injustice or unrighteousness. Justice and righteousness of a judge, and when ascribed to God, as such also denote judging according to truth between opposing and contending parties, justifying the innocent and injured, espousing, vindicating, and maintaining his cause, and condemning and punishing the guilty and injurious according to his desert, especially when this is necessary to vindicate the character and cause of the injured in the best manner and to make proper restitution for the injury done. Not to do this would be to pervert justice and judgment. This justice, righteousness, or uprightness is essential to a perfect moral character and therefore must be included in infinite moral perfection. It is needless to him who reads the Bible with attention to say that justice in this sense is there constantly ascribed to God, and that he who overlooks this or has wrong notions of it must be ignorant of the moral character of God. Excuse me. And it is important to observe here that God, in the exercise of justice or righteousness, has a proper regard to himself and is disposed to maintain the rights of deity and properly to resent all injuries done to him. And therefore he requires his rational creatures to love him with all their hearts, because this is his due, and has annexed to his law a threatening of a punishment, which is the just desert of the transgression of it, or of any injury done to him. This regard to himself and disposition to assert and maintain his rights and character is expressed when he styles himself a jealous God, who is jealous for his holy name, and will not give his glory to another, neither his praise to graven images. Quote, "For my name's sake, I will defer my anger, and for my praise will I refrain for thee, that I cut thee not off. For mine own sake, even for mine own sake will I do it. For how should my name be polluted? And I will not give my glory to another." Close quote. Here's another quote. "God is jealous, and the Lord revengeth. The Lord will take vengeance on his adversaries, and he reserves wrath for his enemies." Close quote. It belongs to God to vindicate his own rights, his name and character, and see that justice is done to himself, for there is no other being who can have the care of this, or can do it, or see that it is done. But he who is most upright, infinitely righteous, and can do no wrong, and sees what is right in all cases, without any possibility of mistake, is every way qualified to judge, decide, and act in this matter. And it becomes him to do it, and not to regard his own rights and do justice to himself would be infinitely unjust and wrong. As God is infinitely the greatest, and the sum and perfection of all being, and his character, interest, and rights are of infinitely the greatest worth and importance, to disregard his rights and injure him is infinitely the highest instance of injustice that can be. And the exercise of justice and righteousness in the first place and chiefly respects him. And were it possible for God to disregard his own character and not vindicate and maintain his own rights, well, he'd be infinitely far from being just and righteous. And this would be a greater instance of injustice than every possible injury to any creature can be. And therefore, when God is said to be just, it necessarily includes his being just to himself, so that he will do himself no wrong, but will regard and maintain his own rights, and claim and secure the honor due to his name. And if he be injured by any, he will see that complete restitution is made, whatever it may cost him who does the injury. And at the same time, he is infinitely engaged to administer justice through all his dominions, and not to injure any one of his creatures in the least degree. Quote, the judge of all the earth will do right. Close quote. Now, before we leave this head, it must be particularly observed that justice or righteousness, whether taken in a more extensive or in a confined sense, is nothing really distinct from love or goodness, but rather is included in it and essential to it. Though it has been thus distinctly considered, or injustice is directly opposed to goodwill, and goodness will not injure anyone. He therefore, who is perfectly good, must also be perfectly just, and goodness always is and always will be justice. And infinite benevolence or love disposes to maintain and vindicate the rights of all, to administer justice and judgment in every case, to condemn and punish the injurious so far as is necessary to make compensation to the injured. For as universal goodness seeks the greatest general good, it can do no wrong, and is therefore opposed to all ill will, and everything that is contrary to the rights of any being, and to the highest general good. Love, therefore, still appears to comprehend all moral rectitude and excellence, and justice or righteousness in the divine being is nothing but universal, infinite benevolence, considered with relation to particular objects and as acted out in particular circumstances. Number three. Perfect truth and faithfulness are essential to the moral character of God and included in His holiness. His declarations are all perfectly agreeable to the truth, and nothing can be deceived by believing what He says. No one can be deceived by believing what He says. Whatever He promises may be relied upon with the greatest safety, and all His predictions, promises, and threatenings He punctually and completely accomplishes. And here again, it must be observed that truth and faithfulness are not to be distinguished from goodness, as though there were anything in them different from it, and not contained in it and essential to it. For there is no foundation for this, and it would be contrary to the truth. He who is infinitely benevolent must be perfect and unchangeable in truth and faithfulness. For love or goodness is itself truth and faithfulness, acted out in that particular manner and towards those particular objects in which it obtains this denomination. There can be no truth and fidelity where there is no goodness, and where the latter is, there, in some degree, is the former. We have now had some view of the moral character of God, or His holiness, and find it to consist in love or goodness, wisdom, righteousness or justice, truth and faithfulness, and that all is comprehended in love or benevolence, there being not only nothing contrary to this, but nothing really distinct from it, and that is not essential to it. The whole being nothing but infinite goodness, in different views of it, and as it respects different objects. And on this account, then, that we may better understand it, the scriptures speak of it by parts, and call the parts of this whole by different names. But this very important and interesting subject requires yet further consideration, and it is hoped that the following observations will not be useless, but rather tend to cast more light upon it. Roman numeral number 1. When it is said that the moral character of God or his holiness consists in love, in which sense, quote, God is love, close quote, universal, infinite, benevolence, or goodwill is meant by love, and all that which this necessarily implies. And this has been supposed and taken for granted in all that has been already said on this subject, but needs to be more particularly explained and made evident. When God is said to be love, it is evident that the love of benevolence or the goodness of God is here meant from the context where the meaning of the apostle is explained. When it is said, quote, God is love, close quote, the words immediately following are these, quote, in this was manifested the love of God towards us, because that God sent his only begotten Son into the world, that we might live through him. And herein is love. Not that we loved God, but that he loved us and sent us his Son to be the propitiation for our sins. Close quote. Here, the love of benevolence or goodwill only is mentioned as that in which the love of God was manifested and acted out. Therefore, this is the love here intended, when it is said, quote, God is love, close quote. It is love of goodwill to enemies, to men in a state of rebellion against God, and therefore the most disinterested, generous love and goodness. This is the love and goodness spoken of by the Lord Jesus Christ when he says, quote, God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whosoever believeth in him should not perish, but have everlasting life. Close quote. This is by the angels called good will to men. This is the highest instance of the most pure, disinterested benevolence or goodness, in which God has made the clearest discovery of his infinite goodness, and so of all his moral perfections that creatures have ever beheld. This benevolence has the highest good of being in general for its object, being capable of life and happiness. It discerns what is the supreme, greatest good, and this it seeks and pursues with unerring wisdom, and being attended with omnipotence. All the infinite good, the proper object of infinite benevolence, which is discerned, willed, and sought, must take place in the highest possible degree, without the least defect. This is universal benevolence, disinterested, unlimited, infinite goodness, which has the highest possible good of being in general for its object, that is, infinite good, which must infallibly take place and be enjoyed forever. Roman numeral number 2. This love of benevolence does not exclude, but necessarily includes, that which is called love of complacence. For he who is good, benevolent, and friendly must delight in goodness. He will not only take pleasure in the exercise of goodness, but will be pleased with benevolence wherever it exists. and therefore a complacency and delight in holiness or moral excellence is always implied in holiness. And God is therefore represented in the scriptures as delighting and taking pleasure in the upright, in them that fear him and are truly holy, and delighting in the exercise of loving kindness, judgment, and righteousness. But it ought to be remembered that the love of complacency is not the primary or chief part of holy love. For holiness must exist as the object of complacency in order to the existence of the latter. And what can this holiness be, which is the object of complacency and the spring of holy delight, but the love of benevolence or goodness? And this is the primary and most essential part, yes, the sum of holy love, which implies the love of complacency in its nature, the latter being a branch, an emanation from the former. And therefore, when we think and speak of holy love, benevolence should be the primary and chief idea in our minds, as being the sum of all and implying the whole. For holy complacency is complacency in benevolence, and a benevolent complacency. And if we leave benevolence out of our idea of the love of complacency, we have no idea of true holiness, nor understand the scriptures where they speak of holy love in God or his creatures. It is true indeed that moral excellence, or the love of benevolence and complacency, may be the object of benevolence as well as complacency. For the more excellent any being is, the greater is his importance and worth, and his interest so much more valuable. And indeed, the more existence he has, for excellence is real existence. And therefore, there will not only be a more complacence and delight in such a being, but he is more the object of benevolence in wishing him well, prosperous, and happy, and doing him good if he stands in need, and there is opportunity, and in being friendly to his existence, prosperity and happiness, and rejoicing in the same. But this is not the primary object of benevolence, but what may be called the secondary object, which appears from what has been said. For benevolence is good will to being, and seeks the greatest good of the whole, and therefore loves those who have no excellence, and wishes well even to enemies, but is exercised in a stronger degree, and in a peculiar manner towards those things who are themselves benevolent, and friends to the general good, while at the same time they are the only objects of complacence and delight. Roman numeral number 3. Divine love or goodness is perfectly disinterested, in opposition to all self-love or selfishness. And this is expressed by uprightness or righteousness, and consists in it. Uprightness is ascribed to God in the scriptures as essential to his character. Yea, he is called, quote, the most upright, close quote. That is perfectly, infinitely, and unchangeably so. And this is opposed to partiality, which consists in self-love and is selfishness itself. True goodness or love is in its own nature uprightness or disinterested, in opposition to this self-love, which is in its nature partiality and unrighteousness, and contains in it the essence and sum of all that which is opposed to true holiness, and that is all sin. And therefore we must exclude from the love in which the divine holiness consists all that can be properly called self-love, all selfish, partial, interested affection, and consider the holiness of God as infinitely opposed to all this. Roman numeral number 4. God himself is the object of his own love and goodness, or in the exercise of his love, he has respect and regard to deity as well as to creatures. This is necessarily implied in perfect, universal, infinite benevolence, which includes impartial uprightness and righteousness. For it would be infinitely otherwise, and the most partial unrighteous affection, if there were no regard paid to the infinite fountain and sum of all being and perfection. That which is friendly to the greatest universal good of existence, and is most pleased and delighted with the highest moral perfection, must regard the interest of the supreme head of the universe, and delight in the most perfect beauty and excellence. And hence follows that God is the chief and supreme object of his own love and regard, and he loves and regards himself more infinitely than the whole of creation, and makes himself his highest and last end of all, and therefore has made all things for himself, as the scriptures assert. This has nothing of the nature of what is called self-love in creatures, but is directly and perfectly opposed to it. There is not the least partiality and selfishness in it, but the contrary, and is uprightness and righteousness itself, as has been shown. For if God did not love and regard himself, his rights and interests, according to his own existence, importance, and excellence, he would not be just, impartial, and upright. Impartial, disinterested benevolence and affection must pay the greatest regard to the greatest and best being. And therefore, to suppose this is partiality and selfishness is most unreasonable and a direct contradiction. This evident truth, which may be so easily demonstrated, ought to be impressed on our minds and never forgotten. For if it be out of view and completely disregarded, we cannot have right conceptions of God or understand the Holy Scriptures, and must be in darkness with respect to the most important doctrines of Christianity, and not know wherein true religion consists. Many, by making a mistake here and considering the love of God as having no respect to himself, but completely exercised towards his creatures, in seeking their good and happiness only, have conceived of him as an almighty tool or servant, existing only for the sake of the creature, and seeking nothing but their happiness, and hence have gone into a scheme of doctrines and religion which is completely selfish and as contrary to the Holy Scriptures as darkness is to light. Let it then be fixed and remembered that God is love. He is infinite benevolence and goodness itself, and that he himself is the first, chief, and last object of this love, so that he regards himself supremely and ultimately in all his works, and does everything for himself, for his own sake, and that his wisdom and righteousness consist chiefly in this, as he would be neither just, faithful, nor wise, should he forget himself, and have no regard to his rights and character in any one thing that he does through all his dominions. And therefore, to suppose he does, is to entertain the most dishonorable thought of him, which is in the highest degree tarnishing, and it ruins his moral character. In the light of this truth, rightly understood and cordially embraced, we shall have great assistance in finding the meaning of the Holy Scriptures and determining what are the important doctrines there revealed, and see their consistence and beauty. Roman numeral number 5. Infinite benevolence or goodness, which seeks and promotes the greatest good of the whole, is infinitely opposed to all malevolence or ill will, which opposes all the good of being, and tends to universal evil, and must be infinitely displeased with it. This is just as evident and certain as it is that he who loves and is friendly to any particular character or desirable object is displeased with the contrary and hates it to as great a degree as he loves and is pleased with the other. And this displeasure and hatred is implied in his love to the opposite object and pleasure in it, and is really the same affection acting towards opposite objects. He who is a friend to the greatest good, and therefore is pleased with such friendship, must be equally an enemy to all who oppose this good, and proportionately displeased and angry with them. And this displeasure, hatred, and anger in a perfectly benevolent being is nothing in nature different from benevolence. It is nothing but goodness opposing its contrary, which it must do, or else cease to be love and goodness. Agreeable to this, the scriptures represent God, who is infinite love and goodness, to be in a proportionable degree displeased with all sin, which is in its nature opposition to benevolence and to the general good. And this is represented as the object of his implacable hatred, and as exciting his anger, indignation, wrath, and fury. This is so far from leading us to conceive of anything in God contrary to infinite love and goodness, or really distinct from it, that is nothing more than benevolence acting according to its own nature towards objects that oppose it. For love of good is itself opposition to evil and hatred of it. And benevolence must be displeased with ill will, and hate and oppose the same. Nor are these opposite or different affections, but rather the same affection, love, acting towards different objects. This displeasure, anger, and wrath of God against sin and the sinner may therefore with propriety be called just and benevolent, a just, benevolent kind of displeasure, which is the same with holy displeasure, all proceeding from love and implied in it. Therefore, when we read in the scriptures of the divine displeasure, anger, wrath, etc., we must not form the same idea of this as we do of those passions as they exist in mankind. For this would be to conceive of God as exercising affections and passions contrary to love, and as very imperfect, changeable, and miserable. And we must exclude in our minds everything that implies imperfection or change of mood, and that is inconsistent with infinite benevolence and felicity. And understand those expressions in the scriptures as meaning perfect, unchangeable opposition of God to everything in moral agents that is contrary to infinite benevolence or goodness, for which they are completely blamable and answerable and deserve to be punished. And these words are doubtless the best chosen and most fit to convey to us this idea of infinite love, considered as opposed, injured, and affronted by selfish creatures and acting accordingly. Roman numeral number 6. The infinite love and goodness of God, which has been described above, which is opposed to everything in creatures that is contrary to itself, and with which it is displeased, must be disposed to manifest this displeasure and opposition to sin in all proper ways, and to punish the sinner according to his desert, whenever this is necessary in order to show his displeasure, to assert and vindicate his own character, and secure and promote the greatest good of the whole. It is proper and desirable that infinite benevolence and goodness should be manifested and acted out in all instances where there is opportunity for it, and therefore in its opposition to sin. For if it does not appear how opposite the moral character of God is to all sin, it cannot be set in the most clear and advantageous light. But this cannot be done if opposition to this character be not punished in any instance or way according to its desert. Besides, when thus to punish is necessary in order to support the character of God and secure the general good, not to do it would be injustice to himself and the creation. Therefore, to punish in this case is the proper and necessary exercise of justice and righteousness, which has been shown is included in goodness and is an exercise of the same. And it is therefore evident that God's manifesting his displeasure and anger with the creature who is an enemy to his goodness is not only consistent with infinite benevolence, but an expression and exercise of love and goodness itself. And it would be contrary to the nature and dictates of the most perfect goodness not to punish. And it may be added, such punishment is not the least evidence of a lack of benevolence to the creature being punished. When a judge orders a criminal who is guilty of treason against his king and country to be put to death, He does nothing contrary to perfect benevolence and goodness. But rather, this is the very conduct. This very conduct is an expression of it, and dictated by goodness itself. For he herein acts as a friend to his king and country, and not to inflict this punishment would be unfriendly and contrary to true goodness. And I would note the moratorium on the death penalty by the United Nations, December 18th, 2007, as an example of what is not benevolent. Nor does he manifest any lack of benevolence to the criminal, or of a proper regard for his life and welfare, by punishing him according to his deserts, when the public and general good require it. The disposition of the Most High to inflict punishment, and his actually inflicting evil on his creatures, as a testimony of his displeasure towards sin, and to vindicate his own character, is often called vengeance in the scriptures, and is represented by his taking or executing vengeance and being avenged on his enemies. And in this view, he is frequently called the mighty and terrible God, with whom is terrible majesty, etc. If God were not disposed to punish his creatures for their rebellion against him, and never did inflict evil on any for their sin, vengeance or vindictive justice could not be ascribed to him, nor would there be anything terrible in his character, which would be an imperfection and inconsistent with infinite benevolence or goodness, as has been shown. And therefore, they who form notions of a love and goodness in which there is no wrath and vengeance to punish enemies, nor any terrible majesty, and ascribe such love to God, have conceptions of his moral character which are essentially wrong and very dishonorable to him. Roman numeral number 7. It appears from what has been said, and from reason as well as scripture, that the moral perfection of God, or the divine holiness, consists in one most simple, pure, uncompounded, unchangeable act. Though to accommodate it to our imperfect way of conception, it be divided into parts and a number of attributes, and called by different names, as it is exercised in different views towards various and opposite objects. Benevolence or goodness is mercy, grace, compassion, patience, long-suffering, etc. And the same benevolence is wisdom, justice, truth, faithfulness, complacence, displeasure, anger, and wrath in different views and as it respects different objects. Roman numeral number 8. Absolute, uncontrollable sovereignty may be considered as included in the moral character of God. This is the same with omnipotent love or goodness, benevolence doing whatever it pleases, infinitely above any control or obligation to any other being. Omnipotence is indeed a natural perfection, but benevolence, clothed with omnipotence, or doing what it pleases, is the essence of God's moral perfection. And if we leave out the idea of this sovereignty, we shall have not only an imperfect but instead a wrong view of divine benevolence. Indeed, if we should conceive of divine sovereignty, as some seem to have done, as consisting in God's doing what he will, merely because he will, and without any possible reason why he wills thus, rather than the contrary, well, this would be so far from a moral perfection that it would be no perfection, but infinitely undesirable and unbecoming of the Most High, representing him rather as an almighty despot and tyrant than an infinitely wise and good being. Though God does what he pleases and is infinitely above all obligation or control by the creature, yet he has a good reason for all his determinations and always wills that which is most wise, and the dictate of infinite rectitude and goodness. It is most agreeable, desirable, and of infinite importance that infinite goodness and wisdom should be sovereign goodness, that is, above all possible control or obligation to the creature, which is inconsistent with its doing what it pleases, or with God's, quote, fulfilling all the good pleasure of his goodness, close quote. All the friends of God who can confide in his goodness, wisdom, and righteousness must be pleased with this sovereignty and rejoice that he is above all control, doing whatever he pleases through all his dominions and, quote, working all things according to the counsel of his own will, close quote. And the idea and acknowledgement of the sovereignty of God attends all their views and pleasing sense of his moral character. And this is the same with rejoicing that the Lord God omnipotent reigneth, which all good beings are represented to do. For to be under the least control or involuntary obligation is inconsistent with reigning, which consists in doing whatsoever he pleases. When it is said, however, that God reigns above all obligation to anyone, which is inconsistent with his doing what he pleases, it is not meant that he can in no instance be under obligation to his creatures. He may enter into voluntary obligation by promise and covenant. For it may be truly said that what God has promised he will do, he is obliged to fulfill. But all must be sensible that this is not in the least inconsistent with the most perfect sovereignty, as it has been now described. Roman numeral number 9. God is independently, infinitely, and unchangeably happy. And this may be considered as included in his moral perfection and character, and depending upon it. For his happiness is not properly a natural, but rather a moral good, and consists in moral exercises and enjoyment. If God were not benevolence or love, he would not be happy. But his infinite greatness, understanding, etc., would render him infinitely miserable. And therefore, his moral character is essential to his felicity. And he is blessed forever, because he is unchangeably holy. And his happiness is a holy happiness. This attribute of God is essential to complete his infinitely glorious character, and is most pleasing and delightful to all his true friends. And their benevolence or good will to God is gratified and expressed in seeing and rejoicing in his infinite, unchangeable, independent felicity and blessedness, and adding their hearty amen to it, as Paul the Apostle did whenever he spoke of it. Quote, who is over all? God, blessed forever. Amen. Close quote. Here, it must, however, be observed that when it is said God is independently happy, it is not meant that he takes no pleasure in his works of creation and providence, or delight in the holiness and happiness of his creatures, so that he would be as completely happy were there no holy and happy creatures or no creation. For this is contrary to the scriptures, which represent God as pleased with his own works, and creating all things for his own pleasure, and as delighting in his holy creatures, and in exercising loving kindness, judgment, and righteousness in the earth. So that it is not strictly true that creatures add nothing to the enjoyment or happiness of God, even his essential happiness, and that he would have been as completely blessed forever as he really is had there been no creatures, which has been far too often asserted, even in solemn addresses to God. Though the creation, with all its attendants and eternal consequences, be essential to the infinite happiness of God, and he could not have been so happy without it, this does not suppose him in the least dependent upon the creature for his happiness, or for anything else. For the creation is absolutely, perfectly, and in all respects dependent upon him, being only an emanation from his infinite fullness. And he is as independent of his creatures as if they never had existed, and he took no pleasure in them. And nor is this inconsistent with the eternal, unchangeable happiness of God. For he, from eternity, perfectly enjoyed the creation and every event that will take place to all eternity without any change or succession of past, present, and future with respect to himself. This scriptures indeed speak of God as repenting that he had made man and being grieved at his heart, which, when spoken of man, denote uneasiness and pain. But these expressions concerning God cannot reasonably be understood as meaning any such thing, and only denote that the great wickedness and misery of man are so contrary and displeasing to the holiness and goodness of God, that were he a man, or his goodness as limited and imperfect as that of man, it would be very grievous to him, and make him repent that man never existed, or that man ever existed. And these words are doubtless wisely chosen, as best suited to convey this idea to us, and gives us a proper sense of the exceeding wickedness and misery of man in the sight of God, even so as to render his existence infinitely worse than nothing should things take their natural course and not be checked and overruled by infinite power and wisdom. If God speak to men, he must speak after the manner of men. And now we come to the reflections from chapter 2. Please take these reflections into consideration as well. There's a lot given today. A lot. I myself learned a lot from reading it. Okay? I know you will too. Lord willing. Reflections. From the view we have now taken of the evidence of the existence of God and his character and perfection, we may infer the following things. Number one, what is meant by seeing God, or a true sensibility of his being and character? God is infinite power, knowledge, goodness, wisdom, justice, and righteousness, unchangeable, eternal, everywhere present. To see God is to have some proper discerning and sense of all these, and so as to make suitable impressions upon the mind. And as the human mind is infinitely unequal to an adequate or comprehensive view of God, and cannot at once see all that it is capable of seeing, we view this infinite whole by parts, and maybe sometimes attend to infinite power more particularly, or to wisdom or goodness, and have a more affecting, pleasing sense of those than of other perfections, though not excluding them. A discerning sensibility of anything in God is seeing him. Roman numeral number 2. We hence learn what a foundation and source there is in the being and perfections of God for the complete and eternal happiness of those who know and love him. In God there is everything that is agreeable and desirable to an infinite degree, and no possible blemish or defect. Nothing that can be in the least disagreeable to a mind of a right taste and disposition. His whole character is superlatively beautiful, bright, and excellent, and it is impossible that it should be properly discerned and understood without giving the most noble and high kind of enjoyment. And perfect discerning and love of this infinitely excellent and glorious being, accompanied with an assurance of his love and favor, must be the most perfect and highest kind of happiness of which we are capable or can have any conception. In this view, the truth and propriety of our Savior's words appear in a striking light. Quote, "And this is life eternal, that they might know thee, the only true God, and Jesus Christ, whom thou hast sent." Close quote. And as this infinitely excellent and glorious object is unchangeable, eternal, and infinite, he whose happiness consists in the knowledge and enjoyment of him must have not only a perfect and unfailing, but also an increasing happiness, for as the object of his knowledge and love is infinite, there is a foundation for an endless progression or increase of knowledge and love, which is the same with an endless increase of enjoyment and happiness. Roman numeral number 3, a reflection. We hence learn the amazing folly, wickedness, and misery of those who are displeased with the divine character and real enemies to it. And this is true of all those who dislike the laws of God and are unwilling to be under his government and obey him. For the government and laws of God are all like himself and an expression of his own character. There can be no greater crime than direct opposition to God and hatred of him, disaffection to his existence and character. For this must be criminal in proportion to the greatness of God, his importance to being in general, and the excellence of his character, and his authority over us, and his goodness exercised towards us. But he is infinitely great, and therefore his existence is of infinite worth and importance. And as he is excellent, as he is great, his infinite love and friendship to being in general, and his authority over us is great in proportion to his greatness and perfection, our inferiority to him, and dependence upon him. And what is the just and certain consequence from this, if it be not that disaffection and opposition to him is infinitely criminal, that is, a crime of unlimited, infinite magnitude? Then it cannot be proved to be any crime at all. This is certain, if no reason can be given or argument offered to prove that opposition to God and rebellion against him is wrong and criminal, which does not equally prove that the crime is infinitely great. Anyone will doubtless be convinced of this if he will attend to the point so much as to make a trial. Now, the misery of such must be great, if infinite perfection and excellence give them no pleasure, but uneasiness and pain. They are, of course, shut out of all true happiness, and they have no object that they can afford them any enjoyment suited to their natural capacity and strong desires, and therefore must, in their pursuits of happiness, meet with continual vexatious disappointment, which must constantly render them very unhappy. And if they persist in this disaffection to God and opposition to him, and so fall under the just and proper manifestations of his displeasure, and are punished in suffering evil answerable to their crimes, they must necessarily be miserable beyond all conception and without any end. The folly of this is beyond all expression, and the greatest that can be, to turn away from the fountain of all good and perfection and renounce the only object of true enjoyment and happiness, and seek it in a way in which it is not to be found, but issues in complete and endless misery. What instance of folly can be great like this? He's explaining people who say, we're not under the law anymore, we're under grace. These are people who disregard the law. This is who he's referring to. Okay? No wonder the scriptures call such fools, in an emphatical sense, as if this was the sum of all folly. But there were no fools but these. These, in the highest sense, and in the most striking manner, quote, call evil good and good evil. Put darkness for light and light for darkness. Bitter for sweet and sweet for bitter, close quote. The scriptures speak of such in the following language, quote, be astonished, O ye heavens, at this, and be horribly afraid, for my people have committed two evils. They have forsaken me, the fountain of living waters, and hewed them out cisterns, broken cisterns, that can hold no water. For my people are foolish, and they have not known me. They are sottish children, and have no understanding. They are wise to do evil, but to do good, they have no knowledge. Close quote. Roman numeral number 4. This subject leads us to reflect upon the very criminal blindness and great delusion of those who say in their hearts, quote, there is no God, close quote. The scriptures teach us that there are such, And surely we must see the justice and propriety of calling them fools. Quote, "The fool hath said in his heart, there is no God," close quote. That there should be any such of the human race is very shocking and deplorable. But it is more so to have it asserted by God that this is true of all mankind in their natural state. That all are here declared to be such fools naturally is certain from the context, which is quoted by the Apostle Paul and applied to all men. What awful darkness and delusion this must be, in which they are, who, in the midst of the clearest light shining around them, do shut their eyes so as not to see the most evident and important truth, and to be quite blind to the most excellent, charming, and glorious character. And that the heart of man should be thus stupid and blind, even when there is a rational conviction and acknowledgement of the truth, is yet more shocking. And this is the blindness of the heart, spoken of by the Apostle Paul. Quote, "Having the understanding darkened, being alienated from the life of God, through the ignorance that is in them, because of the blindness of their heart," close quote. When the light that is in men is, through the moral disorders of the mind, turned into such darkness, oh, how great is that darkness. And this blindness and delusion must be criminal in proportion to the clear and abundant evidence of the truth and the infinite importance and excellence of the object which this darkness hides from the mind. For it is the blindness of the heart, and therefore a moral, voluntary blindness, and cannot be distinguished from disaffection and real opposition of the heart to the being and character of God. And, consequently, the whole of it is nothing but sin. And in this light, therefore, the scriptures everywhere represent this sort of blindness and delusion, which originates from the heart and consists essentially in the moral disorders and depravity of the mind. All sin is indeed moral darkness and delusion. It is opposed to all moral truth, and is in its own nature a sort of atheism, as it does in all the exercises of it, deny the very God that is above. It is therefore so far from being unaccountable that the scriptures should assert that they whose hearts are completely under the dominion of sin say in their hearts that there is no God, that the reason of it may be easily seen, and it is most evident and certain that it cannot be otherwise, and to assert the contrary is a very gross and palpable contradiction, when all the feelings and exercises of the heart are as if there were no God, or are opposed to his being and moral character, then the heart says, there is no God. And therefore, they who have no true virtue, no love to God, are in the scriptures said not to know God, but to be alienated from the life of God, and without God in the world.